Support for The Exchange podcast comes from you, our listeners, and from McLean Middleton, New Hampshire's largest law firm. For over 100 years, they've been committed to their clients, community, and colleagues. Locations in Manchester, Portsmouth, and Concord, New Hampshire, and Woburn and Boston, Massachusetts. Learn more at McLean.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. Rock climbing is a popular sport in the Granite State, and so many climbers here were thrilled when the film Free Solo, produced by a New Hampshire native, won this year's Oscar for Best Feature Documentary. The movie is about Alex Honnold's ascent up the 3,000-foot face of Yosemite's El Capitan without a rope. The film was, of course, fascinating for climbers, but it also opened the eyes of the general public on the physical, mental, and ethical aspects of this sport. Now, a new book by a New Hampshire author and avid climber himself pulls together all these themes. It's called The Impossible Climb, Alex Honnold, El Capitan, and the Climbing Life. The author, Mark Sinnott, is with us in studio, and let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Mark, it's really good to meet you. Thank you so much for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So I saw the documentary Free Solo. I read your book. And like a lot of non-climbers, my first thought was, why do people do this? Climb up giant rock faces without a rope? That was my thought the whole time I was watching that movie.
It's a great question. And I would say that this book is my 400-page answer to that question. I'm not sure if it's possible to answer that succinctly. I have thought about it a lot, and I guess one thing I could tell you is that I've traced this all back, you know, through my life, and I think I climbed for something like 17 years before I even asked myself that question. I never thought about it, and I didn't care, and it took a long time before I finally got to the point that it really sunk in, like how absurd it is what we do.
Like, what am I doing up here?
Especially when, you know, it's one thing if it's just a hobby, but if you dedicate your entire life to climbing and you build your whole existence around it, you're probably going to have a moment at some point where you realize that it is kind of absurd and you'll start to question it. But it took a long time before, you know, I got to that point, and I started climbing when I was 15, and I'm 49 now. So I've been doing it for 34 years, and so I guess actually, yeah, for half of my climbing career, I never really thought about it. For the second half, I've been thinking about it a lot, and this book is kind of my answer.
You describe in the book, Mark, how you love to climb since you were little, and there's some really fun stories in there. Climbing on neighborhood roofs, for example. All sorts of stuff. What were some of your early climbing experiences?
I've told the story in the book and, you know, talks and stuff over and over about my very first official climb was at Cathedral Ledge in North Conway. And a buddy and I just kind of got the wild hair to try to climb the cliff, but we didn't know anything at all about climbing. And our how-to manual, if you want to call it that, was a poster that my dad had bought me at a shop in North Conway called IME, and it was a picture of this guy hanging from an overhang with a rope tied around his waist. But what no one told me was that the poster was vintage from the early days before, like, modern climbing had been invented. So we thought, okay, we'll just do what the guy in the poster is doing. And so I remember going to the tool shed and looking for a rope and finding one. And it was, you know, like one of those white utility ropes you get at the hardware store. And then we asked
my
dad.
For all the weight of your 15-year-old body.
Yes. And then we asked my dad to give us a ride into North Conway. And my dad was the classic 1980s, 1970s style parent, which was whatever would be the exact opposite of a helicopter parent. And so he never really paid a whole lot of attention to what we were doing. But I remember that day when he dropped us at the cliff and saw the wall in the background and the two 15-year-old kids with the clothesline, that he realized that something was up. But my
buddy, didn't he say something, though? You know, what are you guys doing?
He did. He noticed that something was up, and I described the scene in the book, but I remember my dad sitting in the lemon-colored Chrysler station wagon with the wood panel on the side, and he had his arm hanging out the window, and he asked me what was up, and I looked back at him, and I said, "Dad, don't worry about it." And I distinctly remember his arm, like, kind of, you know, his brawny dad arm hanging out the window of the car, and then he just went, and he slapped the wood panel. He said, "Sounds good. See you guys later." And he drove away. Very different from my parenting style. But yeah, you know, my parents let me, you know, kind of run wild. And, you know, I think that was, you know, a big part of why I got into climbing. You know, one other story that I've told is that my dad was a banker. And I grew up in a suburb of Boston. And we would always come to New Hampshire. And we came up here to ski and to do outdoor stuff. And we would pick my dad up at the bank on Friday afternoons, and he and my mom would sit in the front seat, and they would talk about banking. And I was kind of an annoying kid, and my parents would give me money to be quiet for the entire ride, and it was usually the pay was 25 cents. And so for, you know, a huge chunk of my childhood, I sat in the back seat of these vehicles listening to my dad describe what banking was like. And it really sunk in, and it made me realize that that wasn't the direction that I wanted to go.
He wasn't happy. He was complaining about people backstabbing him and this one and that one and so forth.
Correct. And I, you know, was like a 10-year-old kid listening to that, and it sunk in deep. And so then when I, you know, grew up and got to the point where I could chart out my own path, I decided to go in the complete opposite direction of, you know, the one that he had gone in.
Since you mentioned Cathedral Ledge, Mark, some listeners may not realize that New Hampshire actually has a fair bit of credibility, standing, respect, whatever you want to call it, in the climbing world. What's our reputation among climbers nationally and even internationally?
Well, as you know, this is the Granite State, and we have tons and tons of granite cliffs in New Hampshire, and I don't, maybe people don't realize that. Cathedral Ledge, North Conway, which we were discussing, is one of the premier cliffs in the East. So people come from all over to climb on Cathedral Ledge. People come from, you know, from international, like we'll see people from Europe checking it out. You've got Cannon Cliff over in Franconia, which is a 1,000-foot high cliff, and that's really like where you can find some awesome adventure climbing. You've got all the stuff on Mount Washington, you know, you've got Huntington Ravine, and then hundreds of smaller crags, some of which are still being discovered to this day. And one thing that's really unique here is the opportunity that we have for winter climbing, because we have so much water and seepage and stuff like that on all the cliffs. So we have world-class ice climbing and mixed climbing, which is a combination of ice and rock climbing, where you're going up like maybe a rock face that has like just a smattering of ice on it, and you have like one pick of your axe in a crack in the rock and the other's in ice. And we have some of the best mixed climbing in the world right here in New Hampshire.
Well, since we're getting into some of the definitions, I did want to get a couple out of the way with you, Mark, and then we'll get into the whole story of how you became an elite climber, how you met Alex Honnold, that climb that a lot of people saw in the documentary, the free solo up El Capitan. I want to remind our listeners that you can join us too. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Our email exchange at nhpr.org. Our guest today, Mark Sinnott. He's the author of The Impossible Climb. That's the name of the book. Alex Honnold, El Capitan, and The Climbing Life. If you are part of The Climbing Life, of course, we want to hear from you. Or if you've seen people rock and ice climbing and you've just wondered about it, we'd like to hear from you too. Again, our email, exchange at nhpr.org. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Without getting too detailed, Mark, please, tell us what the difference is between climbing, and free soloing, because that's important with this story.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. Well, I mean, we all know what climbing is, right? So you just climb a tree or whatever that might be. I think that's something that's part of our DNA as human beings. The reason why this question is important is because I think almost everyone confuses free climbing with free solo. And it's something that I try to lay out in the book. Basically, free climbing is going up a cliff purely under your own power. So you're using your hands and feet, but you have a rope, and the rope is used to create a safety net in case you fall. So you put protection in the wall, you clip your rope into that protection. If you're doing a longer climb that is taller than the length of your rope, we call that multi-pitch, you would stop along the way, place an anchor in the rock, secure yourself to that anchor, then you would belay your partner up, who would take the pieces out that you put in. And nowadays we can do this in such a way that you can go do a climb and walk away and it will look exactly the same as it was when you came up to it. So no one would know that you had gone up it. Free solo is that same process of free climbing, but you take the rope away. And so there's no safety net. And that's what Alex did on El Capitan.
Have you free soloed, Mark?
Yeah, I have free soloed. I've been doing some free soloing recently on, you know, some ice routes.
Ice routes?
Yep. And I wouldn't call myself a free soloist, but, you know, as someone who's climbed for a good chunk of my life, I do sometimes go without a rope. And I think that's maybe something that people don't realize, is that free soloing is part of being a climber. And I think also people might not realize that oftentimes, even when you have a rope, you might as well be free soloing, because the fall could still be really serious or fatal, because your protection in the rock might not be good. You could hit a ledge and bust yourself all up. So yeah, I've always climbed without a rope. I still do. I don't, you know, do it at a high level or anything like that.
But, how do you decide when to take a rock wall free solo and when it would be best to rope up?
Well, part of it is just how you feel and, you know, what you want to do. And I think a really important thing as a climber is to follow your heart and to listen to what it's telling you. I mean, that's a huge part of this story here in the Impossible Climb. You know, everyone's asking about Alex and what he did. He wanted to go up El Cap without a rope. No one else really wanted to do that. He's the only one.
Gee, I can't imagine why.
And sometimes you just get the feeling, you know? And it is pretty nice to go by yourself. You don't have to line anybody else up. You don't have to carry a rope. You don't have to carry any of the gear. You know, I think people would think, oh, it's really scary, but you know, and I don't mean to make myself sound like a big free soloist, but when I do go and I climb without a rope, I never get scared at all, because I wouldn't do it if I was. I'm only doing things that I'm totally, completely comfortable with, and it's really, really fun.
What makes it fun?
That's kind of hard to describe, I guess, but I think that was what I was getting at when I was talking about how I never questioned why I climbed for so long. There's something joyful about it, and I think anybody who's done it, most people will feel that. And I think, you know, it may have to do with the fact that we used to live in trees, and I think climbing, as I mentioned, is part of our DNA. I really don't know why it is. But I know every time I climb, whatever the medium is, you know, rock or ice or anything in between, I just experience joy. And I love it and always have.
Something to do with both the physicality of it. You're moving, so there's those endorphins being released. But maybe it's also, Mark, you tell me, a sense of freedom.
Yeah, the freedom is definitely a big part of it. And you know, there's no type of climbing that's more pure than going up by yourself without a rope. You know, you don't have all the things encumbering you that you do when you're climbing with a rope. Some of the climbs that I've done, and I've described these in the book, I've done a lot of big wall climbing, like going up giant cliffs, and you know, like I did one in Baffin Island where we're on the wall for 39 days. I mean, the amount of encumbrances that we had, all the ropes and the bags full of all our gear and the portaledge that we're sleeping in and the racks of pitons and the bolt kit and all the food and stove and fuel, it's a lot. And that's almost like the exact opposite of, you know, going up with nothing.
You mentioned encumbrances and so forth, and one of the most interesting parts for me about the book was the newer encumbrance of people wanting to film you, people wanting to follow you, people wanting to watch you, people wanting daily updates of what you were doing in some of your big climbs. We're definitely going to talk about that because that's super interesting. But I also want to remind our listeners, Mark, that they can join us. The number for you to be part of our conversation today with Mark Sinnott, the book is The Impossible Climb, Alex Honnold, El Capitan and the Climbing Life, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email. We'd love your questions. exchange@nhpr.org. And Mark, Jim in Manchester is giving us a call. So go ahead, Jim, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, how you doing? I'm from Manchester, and I grew up not too far from an outcrop called Rock Rimmon. And I'm wondering, you know, can we find a way for rock climbing to not simply be sort of something from the for the educated elite, but maybe the center city kids could get that same high and that same feeling of accomplishment if they were just taught how to climb smaller rock outcrops that are all around our cities, including Rock Rimmon and Manchester.
Jim, thank you so much. And it does give you a feeling of accomplishment. Even me in these silly climbing gyms, you know, you do feel an accomplishment when you get to the top of the wall and you get to ring the bell. Thank you so much for the question, Jim. Go ahead, Mark. What do you think?
Yeah, I think he's right on the money with that. You know, get kids outside, get them to appreciate nature, to challenge, you know, themselves physically and mentally, as we've been discussing. There are groups that specifically are endeavoring to do what Jim is describing. One in particular is called Kismet, K-I-S-M-E-T, and they're based up in North Conway, and they do exactly what Jim is describing. I think they actually take kids out from Manchester and other places where, you know, they wouldn't have the opportunity to climb. It's a nonprofit organization. People should check it out. I mean, they're doing awesome work, exactly like what he's describing.
How do you feel in general about climbing walls, Mark?
Indoor climbing walls?
Yeah. It's become a big thing in the last 20 years.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's great. You know, the more people that are exposed to this sport, the better, in my opinion. I think, you know, I have four children from 20 down to 3, and I see what life is like now in, you know, the digital age, if you want to call it that. And I think anything that gets the kids away from their phones and screens, gets them outside, enjoying nature is an awesome thing. I mean, I know some people worry a little bit about, you know, the impact on the environment, but I think those people are kind of missing the point that the worst thing would be for people not to be outside and enjoying nature, because the more people that are out there, in particular this upcoming generation, the more time they spend out there, the more they're going to love it, and the more they love it, the more they're going to take care of it.
All right, coming up, we will talk about digital technology, how it has affected the sport of climbing. So many people watching, so many people photographing and filming. That's been an issue, I know, for you, Mark, and it was an issue with Alex Honnold's big free solo up El Capitan. So we'll talk about that after a short break. And we'd love to keep hearing from you. Jim, thank you for that phone call. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. More with Mark Sinnott on The Impossible Climb in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is NHPR. Good morning. It's hard to keep track of all the presidential candidates as they dash in and out of the state. Stay tuned to NHPR, your source for the latest in New Hampshire's first-in-the-nation presidential primary. And you can find all of our primary coverage at nhpr.org/primary2020. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Gibson's Bookstore in Concord, a downtown meeting place for books, greeting cards, games, toys, and coffee. Calendar of author book signings and events at gibsonsbookstore.com. And from Northeast Credit Union, providing home loans in New Hampshire, Maine, and Vermont. Learn more at necu.org. Insured NCUA. This is NHPR.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest and You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, New Hampshire writer and elite climber Mark Sinnott. His new book is called The Impossible Climb, Alex Honnold, El Capitan, and the Climbing Life. Let's hear from you. Whether you're part of what Sinnott calls the climbing life or you've wondered about it, your comments are welcome, of course. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. And Mark, I want to jump into something that is a big part of this book and comes up in the movie Free Solo as well, that documents Alex Honnold's climb up El Capitan. And that's the idea of a wider audience when you start climbing. It's an issue that the climbing community has long struggled with, the issue of purity. So first of all, what are some of the first iterations of that purity debate in the climbing community?
I kind of had a feeling you were going to ask me about that, you know, and it's something that I write about in the book. And I traced it back to a guy named Paul Preuss, who was an Austrian climber in the early 1900s.
Oh, that and, far back.
Yeah, I think he was the first one that really introduced, you know, sort of like a ethos of purity in climbing. And that was back in the day when, you know, they were just starting to invent some of the devices, you know, that we use nowadays with pitons and carabiners and some of that kind of stuff.
And you should just tell non-climbing listeners what pitons and carabiners are.
Yeah, so a piton is basically like a nail. It's like a giant nail that has a little eyelet on it. And you take a hammer and you pound it into the rock, and then you can clip your rope into that through the carabiner, which is kind of like this snap link device that has a little gate. So you pound in the piton, you put the carabiner through there, and then you clip your rope through that. And Preuss, you know, his philosophy was to use as little as he possibly could. And what he was actually doing was many, many first ascents in the Alps where he didn't use a rope, but he wouldn't even carry a rope. And so then he would climb back down the same way that he went up.
So was he free soloing?
He was free soloing. And he was doing first ascents, you know, on site, which means never having seen the route before, no idea what's coming up. And I've actually climbed some of his routes in the Dolomites. And I mean, you wouldn't believe, like even now, like modern age with ropes and all our gear, you look at some of these things and you're like, okay, like we'll get up this, but it's going to be serious. This guy was doing it in the early 1900s with absolutely nothing and then climbing back down. Part of the story is that he eventually fell in 1913. I think he was, you know, 27 or something like that. So that's where it all started. Then it went into a little bit of what I call in the book, I think, like a dark age, where there was nothing really of note that happened for about 60 years. And the next guy to come along was a close friend of mine named Henry Barber. And Henry lives in New Hampshire. He lives in North Conway. He's a legendary climber. And he sort of picked up the torch from Preuss and started doing some amazing things, in particular in Yosemite National Park. He was the first person to climb one of the major formations in Yosemite without a rope.
I want to ask you about one purity issue that you just raised, Mark, and that's the idea of climbing on site, meaning it's the first time you've seen this particular climb, versus rehearsing the climb. And this is something that Alex Honnold talked about about his big free solo climb again up El Capitan. And people say, how could he do it? It's so dangerous. But in a TED Talk recently, Alex Honnold describes how he rehearsed this thing roped up over and over again. So when he was up there without a rope, he would know exactly what he was doing. Let's hear a little bit from Alex Honnold.
3,000 feet of climbing represents thousands of distinct hand and foot movements, which is a lot to remember. Many of the moves I knew through sheer repetition. I'd climbed El Cap maybe 50 times over the previous decade with a rope. But this photo shows my preferred method of rehearsing the moves. I'm on the summit, about to rappel down the face with over 1,000 feet of rope to spend the day practicing by myself. Once I found sequences that felt secure and repeatable, I had to memorize them. I had to make sure that they were so deeply ingrained within me that there was no possibility of error. I didn't want to be up on the wall wondering if I was going the right way or using the best holds. I needed everything to feel automatic.
So what are your thoughts there, Mark, about is it more pure to do a climb, quote, on site versus rehearsing it? And who's to judge anyway?
Yeah, that's the, I guess, a great way to put it. It's a personal question, you know, for the climber themselves. You know, in this case, with what Alex did on El Capitan, you know, in today's, you know, sort of current paradigm, it wouldn't be possible for someone to go up and on-site that climb. There's nobody, you know, in the world that's that good or that bold. You know, climbing, like all sports, is an evolution, and the current state of the art in that evolution is Alex getting up the face of El Capitan without a rope. And to do that, he had to rehearse it to give himself, you know, that margin, that safety margin that he would need. If anybody out there wants to one-up Alex, and I wouldn't recommend that, they could try to go and do it on site. You know, I think you heard about this climb in Patagonia that Jim Reynolds just did, where he free soloed Fitzroy, and that's one of the huge iconic peaks of Patagonia. It's just this massive plug of granite, and he free soloed on site up the 5,000-foot rock wall, and then he free soloed back down. So he was really doing kind of like what Paul Preuss was doing back in the early 1900s. The difference is that the route is rated 5'10", and the route that Alex did on El Capitan is a 5'13".
Is that a lot harder?
If you don't know anything about grades, it won't mean anything at all. But we're talking about orders of magnitude more difficult, and it makes a huge, huge difference. So Alex was much closer to his edge in terms of what he would be able to do with a rope than Jim was. Now, they're kind of two different things, which I think could be confusing, you know, to a layperson.
Well, if I could ask you one more question about this, Jim Reynolds, who, as you said, just free soloed up and down a 5,000-foot spire in Patagonia. The Outside Magazine headline says, and I'm quoting, "Reynolds' free soloing feats top those of Alex Honnold, if not in difficulty, then in length, commitment, and style." As a journalist, Mark, how do you feel about this headline, the competition, the comparisons, the sort of swagger, this is better, no, this is better? We're talking about human beings climbing up giant rock walls with no ropes.
Yeah, when I read that you know, that jumped out at me, that, you know, seemed like they were trying to stir the pot a little bit.
Sure. Should we really be doing that?
No.
Or should we just celebrate everybody and say, amazing job?
Yeah, that didn't really sit right with me, I wouldn't say. You know, to turn it into this competition, you know, who's going to do the craziest climb without a rope, as I just described. They're somewhat different endeavors. I mean, I'm sure Alex would just kind of get a chuckle out of that and not be even remotely worried about it, nor would Jim, because I don't think either of those guys are driven, you know, by that kind of thing at all. People that are, you know, climbing at that level and that are right out on the edge and they're putting their life on the line, you know, this will sound a little cliche, but I know these people, and I would say that they're climbing for their soul, and they're not doing it for the recognition, you know, or the glory or whatever money they could make off it. There's no possible way. I mean, I know people might think that, but I know so many people that are, you know, sort of in this climbing tribe, and they're all, you know, just driven by idealistic notions and things like that.
So it's the rest of us that are writing these headlines and saying best, better, top. It's not these guys. They're doing it, as you said, for their souls.
100%. You know, and I mean, I'm a journalist, and I work in media, and I write some of these stories myself, and I know how it all works. And you're trying to get people to read your stuff, you know, and so that's why, you know, magazines do that kind of thing.
Let's take another call, Mark. This is Donald in Berwick, Maine. Hi, Donald. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi.
Go ahead, Donald. You're on the air.
I just wanted to say that I'm a little bit older than your guest, and as a freshman at UNH in the late 50s, I joined the Outing Club, and I got into the rock climbing unit. And our initial trip to do some rock climbing was out to Bald Head Cliff in Algonquin, Maine. We did a little balance climbing on some big boulders and then proceeded to ascend a 90-foot chimney in the face of the cliff with no rope. And so that was my initiation into rock climbing.
Did you see the movie Free Solo, Donald, about Alex Honnold?
Yeah. I haven't, but I have purchased the book. I haven't read it yet. But the fellow who made the movie, I knew his father.
Right. He's from that Durham area.
Yeah, Rick Renner was the man's father. He used to be a physician's assistant at my doctor's.
Well, Don, it's great to hear from you and your stories about free soloing way back when. And let's take another call, Mark. This is Burton calling in from Rye. Hi, Burton. You're on the air as well. Go ahead.
Good morning, Laura.
Morning. Go ahead.
I was just calling to say that I have had the privilege and opportunity to climb almost all of the big cliffs in New Hampshire with my children.
Wow.
Cathedral and Huntington's and particularly the Cannon Cliff. And I was wanting to convey that I think climbing is a very empowering experience, and I think that's why people do it. When you do a big climb and you get to the top, you have a real wow experience about what you've accomplished. And my sons are teaching their children to climb, and many, many of the programs that provide outing experiences for young people often offer climbing experiences. And I think the real reason that people climb is it is a very empowering personal experience.
Yeah, it's challenging, but when you're done, you feel like you really did something. Burton, thank you so much. You've got children, Mark. What's your experience climbing with them?
Well,
not the three-year-old, obviously.
Yeah, he hasn't started yet. I always had this rule, which was kind of a hands-off rule with climbing.
What do you mean?
I didn't want to press climbing on my kids. I didn't want to take them climbing. I didn't want them to feel like I wanted them to climb, even though I knew it could be a great experience. And climbing is a great experience, and it's empowering. And he's absolutely right about that, but it's also very dangerous. And I feel like I appreciate that, you know, after having climbed for as long as I have and having lost a lot of friends to climbing accidents and things like that. So, you know, I have real mixed feelings about it, whether I want my kids to be climbers or not. But if they were to come to the sport, I wanted it to come from their heart, and I didn't want them to do it because they thought that I wanted them to. So I had this rule. I would never ask them to go climbing, and I would wait for them to ask me. My oldest is 20. He never did. 17-year-old, climbed with him a few times. My daughter, who's 13, came to me 2 years ago, and she said, "Hey, what's up with this climbing stuff?" And so now she's kind of my apprentice climber, and we've been doing some cool stuff together. We've been climbing Cathedral Ledge and I'm training her up, and she might be, you know, the one, you know, child of mine that might get into the sport, but I feel good about it because I think she found her way to it on her own.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned your daughter, because watching the movie, reading the book, this climbing life, this climbing community that you describe seems very white, very male, very young. How diverse is the climbing community?
I think it's maybe more diverse than the book reveals. You know, I kind of realized that I only had so many characters, and that they do fit sort of a certain demographic like you're describing. But I mean, I don't know what the statistics are, but if you go to the cliff, you'll see just as many women as men. And
the cliff, you mean Cathedral Cliff?
Yeah, Cathedral Ladger, any cliff. You know, one of the stories that I tell in the book is about Lynn Hill. And Lynn Hill is one of the most legendary climbers that ever lived. She's like at Alex Honnold level. And what she did was, I guess it was in 1992, she free climbed up the nose of El Capitan. And that was kind of like a last great problem of rock climbing. All the best male climbers were trying to do it, and they just couldn't get it done. They weren't even getting close. And
do you think men and women climb differently? Because I've heard some climbers say that.
Yeah, I mean, climbing's all about strength to weight ratio. If you look at the best climbers in the world, they tend to be small, because it's easier to bring more power onto the rock when your body's smaller than when your body's big. And Lynn is small. She also had skinny fingers that were able to get into some of these cracks that other men couldn't do. And really famous, iconic accomplishment of hers in 1992 when she finally free climbed the nose. And the quote, and this is in the book, that she said afterwards was, "It goes, boys." And it was sort of, you know, letting them know that that she had outdone all of them as a woman. And it's an awesome story.
Well, thank you for those calls. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. We're taking your questions, comments, personal experiences, observations about what our guest Mark Sinnott calls the climbing life. Let's return, Mark, if we could, to this debate about what's pure, what isn't. I asked who is the judge and jury in this question of what's pure and what isn't. But the modern debate, Mark, that you really struggled with personally is these days, who's watching, who's photographing, who's funding these expeditions? What's at the heart of that debate, especially now with social media? Everybody has a phone. Everybody can film you doing your stuff.
I think one of the questions that I asked in this book is whether the sort of act of trying to document or capture the purity and the essence of climbing taints the thing that you're trying to document through the process of trying to do that. And that's why I have the chapter in there, something about like crashing the gravy train on the vertical mile, because I had that experience in 1999 when we climbed a mountain in Pakistan called Great Trango Tower. And in trying to get funding for the expedition, we ended up getting sponsored by this internet company called Quokka Sports. And what their plan was to be like a Bloomberg-type terminal for coverage of sports. And instead of having you just turn on the TV and watch like NASCAR or, you know, something like that, they wanted to put you in the car so you could feel what it was like. And so we documented this climb in real time, and we wanted to share the essence of what this type of endeavor is all about with the outside world. And as I describe in the book, it didn't go well.
I'm going to ask you a little bit more about that after a break, because it's really interesting, and I'm sure there's even more of that today than there was 20 or 25 years ago. So we'll talk about that coming up. And we'll keep taking your calls and emails, too. We love your questions. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. More in a moment. ¶¶ This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, we're talking with New Hampshire author Mark Sinnott about the themes in his new book, The Impossible Climb, Alex Honnold, El Capitan, and the Climbing Life. And we've been taking your questions and comments, your stories, your observations about the climbing life. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And Mark, before we go back to our listeners, let's talk a little bit more about this idea of having lots of eyeballs watching your climb as you're doing it. Changes the nature of the climb itself, the relationship of the team. Give us a snippet from that story in the book about that climb you did in Pakistan with Quokka Sports.
Well, imagine going on a climbing expedition with your friends, and you just want to do this big crazy climb. But in the process of trying to get funding to do that climb, you end up with all these strings attached, and you have sponsors, and you have all these commitments, and everybody wants to film and record everything that you're doing.
And these expeditions are expensive, so you need funding.
Yeah, and, you know, so you're sitting there, and instead of just hanging out with your buds, you're hanging out with your buds with people putting a camera in front of you. And recording everything, and sometimes that can make people self-conscious, you know, because we're not actors and we're not used to it, and we're starting to wonder if maybe we said the wrong thing and how you're going to look and all that kind of stuff. And it creates tension, and in our case, you know, and I get pretty deep into this in the book.
Well, and it's fascinating what happened with the climb and the team. Go ahead.
We, we ended up in this situation where we were learning what each other thought of each other through this website that Quokka was producing as the climb was going on. And I tell this story in the book about how Alex Lowe got sick and he had to leave camp. And after he took off, we pulled up the website, and you know, we had these technicians that were running it for us, and I think they kind of teed it up, like they knew what was going on, and they said, "Hey, do you want to check out the website?" And they pulled it up, and this headline came up on the computer screen sitting in base camp in Pakistan, and it said, I think it said, "There's a bad vibe in camp, Alex Lowe."
It's almost like they were trying to create an episode of Survivor.
Yeah, well, the one of the guys that was a principal person at Quokka was a co-creator of Survivor. And so, yes, they were, I think, stirring the pot a little bit, almost like what we were talking about earlier, you know, with magazines and people just trying to, you know, maybe create a little bit of controversy. You know, we had that, and it wasn't a fun experience to be in that position. And I would say that it brought out the worst in all of us. You know, I'd like to say that it brought out the best too, and I guess you could say that it did, because we did eventually come together and we finished the climb. But more than anything, it brought out the worst in all of us. And
it's almost as if it was a fourth entity in your three-person team, and that fourth entity was watching you all the time, reporting, almost whispering back to the rest of the world about what you guys were doing.
Yeah, I mean, the idea, I think, you know, it was sort of a noble idea that we set out, you know, to accomplish, which was to document what it was like to do one of these first ascents. But the, you know, the act of trying to capture the essence of it ruined it. And so what we were capturing wasn't the thing anymore.
What's the way around that, Mark? Because now I'm sure the desire and capability to capture, to document, to follow step by step has only increased. So what's the way to do it positively, given that these expeditions are expensive, given that you need somebody like the North Face, National Geographic, who knows what other website, to help fund it?
I'm actively trying to figure that out myself.
Yeah.
Because I'm still doing, you know, these types of trips, and I'm trying to find the right balance, and I'm trying to maintain my own personal authenticity while still being sponsored and still having strings attached. I've been working as a pro climber now. I started with North Face in 1996, and I'm still on the team, so I've been doing it for 23 years, and I'm constantly, you know, trying to find the sweet spot within all of that. But I observe climbing, you know, and I would say that I'm an insider in this sport, and I see, you know, the ways that people go about this, and there are plenty of people out there who aren't sponsored, and there's some, you know, really amazing climbers right here in New Hampshire, one of whom is a guy I really admire named Mark Ritchie, who you should have onto the program sometime, and you know, he's doing a lot of his climbing without all these strings attached, and it is a lot more more pure, you know, and I'm a little envious of, you know, people like that sometimes. But, you know, I went down this path, and so now, you know, like, this is how I'm doing it.
Well, and it did allow you to see some amazing things and go to some amazing corners of the world that you would not have been able to do on your own budget. I wonder if there's so many eyeballs watching and so many dollars behind a particular climb, Mark, if there's more pressure to make it to the top, even if the weather is telling you otherwise.
Yeah, I would say that's the really the scariest part about
right.
it. You know, you might end up in a place where you start thinking about what you should be doing rather than maybe what you want to do. And you start thinking about, you know, who you're beholden to and what kind of a phone call you're going to have to make to your sponsors when you get back, when you don't make it up the climb. I think most of us are pretty good at, you know, listening to the inner voices and making sure that we don't kind of go awry with all that. I mean, personally, I understand, like, how serious all this stuff is. And so I try to, follow my own internal compass and not, do things that I don't want to do. I mean, I would say over the course of my career, there have been some climbs where I walked up to the base and looked up at, you know, some giant wall like in India or something like that, and said to myself, you know what, I don't know if I actually really want to climb this thing right now. I'm not sure why I'm here. And having experiences like that has helped to, kind of orient me in terms of, you know, what I'm going to do with my time in the future.
Let's go back to our listeners, Mark, and then I want to ask you how Alex Honnold dealt with that idea of being filmed and watched and so forth. But to Goffstown next, where Jackie's on the line. Hi, Jackie. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura, and good morning to you.
Morning. Go ahead.
I wanted to bring greetings to Mark from Tim Martell in Colorado, who apologized for not buying your book, but I want you to know that I just bought it, and it will be making its way to Colorado. And I bring up Tim because he trained my climbing partner, who is his father, and myself. We've been hiking high points in the United States, and Tim trained us on rock and ice and all the equipment, but most importantly, on rope rescue. And all of these skills have transferred so much into everything else I do in my life, whether it's skiing or winter hiking and so on. And I just hadn't heard rescue talked about, so I wanted to bring that up. Also wanted you to know, Laura, when you said not your three-year-old, that I actually know a two-year-old girl who got a climbing harness and helmet for her birthday because she is a natural climber, as my granddaughter appears to be coming on her second birthday. They just love rock. But recently when I've been up in the Jackson area, I've seen a lot of couples climbing together on Cathedral and Whitehorse. And over 30 years, you know, like three decades different in age from these young 20-somethings to people in their late 50s, climbing together, men and women. And what a great thing that is for your trust and communication skills. And my last observation is that when I watch women climb, and I feel myself included, I feel like they do it with their right brain, and it looks like a dance, a work of art. It's not quite so methodical and left brain as men climbing.
Well, Jackie, thank you very much. Lots of observations. And she asked about rope rescue. So I don't even really know what that is, Mark, but I can take a guess.
Yeah, I mean, I might call what she was describing self-rescue, which is just taking care of yourself when you're out in the mountains. So if anything goes wrong, you take care of it, and you don't pull out your cell phone and call 911. So, you know, I am a guide, and I have a guide service where we teach these kind of things. And there's a lot of techniques that you can use to get yourself out of trouble. And some of the most advanced, technical systems that there are in climbing. And I think what's interesting is that a lot of people, sometimes even elite climbers, don't know some of these tricks. And so that's something that we try to teach people. My other involvement in that is with a group called the Mountain Rescue Service, which does high angle rescues in the White Mountains. And so we get called out by the Fish and Game Department, and we go and respond and try to help people out when they get stranded up in Huntington Ravine and stuff like that, or they fall on Cathedral Edge and break their legs.
Here's an email from Lindsay in Stratford who says, I'm just a little concerned with how casual Mark is about free solo climbing. In college, a classmate who was a very experienced climber died doing this. I don't think the danger in this should only be implied. Lindsay, thank you for the email. And there are a lot of people in this book who have died free soloing or doing other types of climbs.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I hope people don't think that I'm casual about any of this climbing
stuff. Alex Honnold had kind of a nickname for you. What did he call you? Captain Safety?
He called me Mr. Safety.
I'm sure you love that.
Yeah, maybe I didn't, describe it as well as I could have, but this isn't just some random thing, that I go and reel off. And, I'm not doing it that often, but when I do, it's something that's done very carefully and methodically and conscientiously and all that kind of stuff. Otherwise, I wouldn't do it. But again, it's part of why I have mixed feelings about my kids getting into climbing, because the thing is, if you climb for your whole life like I have, you almost certainly will end up either climbing without a rope or bouldering up really high or climbing with a rope in situations where you can't fall. And it's the same thing as being a free soloist. And I feel like that's part of climbing. And that's why this sport kind of scares me. And I take it very seriously.
We talked earlier about, again, the eyeballs, the people tracking your every move, filming it, and so forth. How did Alex Honnold feel about that dynamic of so many people watching, wanting to film in the moment? How did that dynamic play out with his big free solo climb up El Capitan?
I would say that ended up being a much bigger challenge than he thought that it was going to be. And that's, a theme that you can see, throughout the book. One of the stories that I tell is about Alex's first attempt to do the climb. That was in November, I think, of 2016, and I was down at the base observing, and he got to this one really scary spot on the sixth pitch where it's this slab move where you have to just put your foot on basically nothing and just kind of glom it onto the rock with no actual foothold, and he didn't feel good about it, and he ended up bailing out, and a couple things. After that, he texted me and he said something, really sorry, about not doing it or something like that. And
sorry I was cautious and saved my life.
Yeah, and I remember just feeling bad
that
when
he felt
I
that
saw
way.
That and I realized that he was feeling that way. And I knew that he must have felt, kind of beholden to all of us, I didn't get it done. And, I really didn't like that idea at all. And then later that night, I had dinner with him, and, we talked about it, and he said, I've had moments like that before when I was soloing, when I knew that I wasn't in the right headspace. And what I would have done was just climb down to the next good ledge and kind of, composed myself and gotten it together mentally. But when I looked up and saw the camera guy right there filming everything that I was doing, and I knew that you guys were at the base and my girlfriend was down there and all these people were observing me, it just felt like too much. And so for that reason, he bailed out.
Wow, so it did make a difference.
It did, and he didn't, you know, he didn't give up, and he continued to struggle with that. And I think it's a really interesting, you know, idea to explore is, you know, this guy that wanted to capture, you know, like the greatest accomplishment of his life for posterity, but the struggle that he went through to do that and to maintain the purity and the state of mind that he needed to be able to do what he did.
How did he end up resolving that internal struggle?
I think he struggled with it right up until the moment that he went for it. You know, I was spending a lot of time with him leading up to the climb, you know, sitting with him in his van, and he was describing a lot of this stuff to me. And there's, you know, a lot of stuff that that he shared that I didn't put in the book because it was just like too personal and kind of too close and a little too raw. What it really came down to was that he wasn't comfortable being filmed on sections where he was right on the edge. And he did not want to be observed when he was in that place. And so what they decided in the end was there's a few spots like that on the route where he wasn't 100% confident, you know, that he was going to be okay with it. And he needed to maintain, you know, his composure and to have as few distractions as possible. And so what they did was they set up remote cameras. And they went up, you know, like the day or the night before, and they strapped tripods to the wall and put cameras on them. And I think, I don't know if they were just running continuously or they were like motion activated, but you can see that in the film. And that was the compromise that they made to, you know, get Alex in the right place to be able to get it done.
Mark, hard to believe we have just about 30 seconds left, but I did want to ask you what's next for you. You have a big trip coming up tomorrow.
Yeah, so tomorrow I'm getting on a plane and I'm flying to Nepal, and then I'm getting in some jeeps and I'm driving to China, and I'm going to try to climb the north face of Mount Everest. And yeah, it's another storytelling mission, and this will be the subject of my next book. And I'm like, this has been awesome, but I'm looking forward to maybe putting this one to bed and moving on to a new story.
Well, come back and tell us that story. Come back safe and sound and tell us your Everest story. Thank you so much for being here, Mark.
Thank you, Laura. This has been great.
That's Mark Sinnott. His book is called The Impossible Climb. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.